Let's do it.
To the right, 5 seconds to go in the first half. Dante fires deep to the left. Moss caught it at the 11, but now he pitches
look at
it.
This.
Demole Williams, touchdown!
You gotta be kidding me!
Welcome to the Climbing the Pocket podcast. My name is Jason Brown. You can find me on Twitter at BrownJason. And this is crazy. With two episodes in a row, we got the whole crew here. JR, what's going on, fam?
What's going on, man? Just happy to be back with you guys. You know, I'm in a happy place when everybody is together. So all is well.
All right, all right, all right. And here we got Miles smirking at JR. So Miles, what's going on? What's good with you guys?
Hey, just excited to talk NBA. Finally, the Timberwolves got something good to talk about.
All right, all right. Saxy Prince, what's good with you, man?
Oh, you know, I might be late, but I'm always on time being late. So
man, you were actually on time today.
Damn,
you,
man.
You beat JR to the pod.
Dang, man. Can't be inconsistent with being late.
Yeah, well, next time I'm sure you'll get us back to where you're supposed to be.
Oh, for sure.
How are things going with theater people?
Great. We released another episode today. Go watch it if you haven't already. Episodes starting to ramp up. We're starting to get a little more character development. The group is starting to mesh. And yeah, the jokes are flying. So I encourage everybody to just go watch it. And a random question of the day. I was just thinking about this because I went out shopping earlier today and went to Rosedale Mall. And there was a little Games and Go store. And in the Games and Go store, they have all the retro old school games and whatnot. So I had to ask you guys, Xbox, you know, I guess Xbox One, PS4, all that stuff. What was your favorite video game console and game growing up? I can start off.
Oh, yeah.
For me, For me, I was a huge N64 guy. And I guess my favorite game, it was kind of a tie between Super Smash Brothers and GoldenEye.
You know, Jason's about to say Atari or something, so.
No, man, just a little after Atari, though, but you close. You know, the old head on here. You know, I rock steady with I had the original Sega. You know, graduated to the Sega Genesis. My mom actually found it when she was moving back up here, so I have it somewhere in this basement.
Gonna try to get it
hooked up somewhere so I can go and play some Madden 93, which was my game back in the day that I played all the time. And then,
'93.
Went to college, N64 was the joint, GoldenEye, Power Weapons in the stacks. Actually had a couple of homies probably fail out of school because of GoldenEye, because all we did back then was just GoldenEye all day, every day. So
you couldn't even play online back then either. That's what's
nah, funny. Man. All of us packed into a single dorm room.
Yeah,
with
you
the
had
wires coming out the front of the
sardine inside of a room. Get four controllers and just straight up, you could look at each other's maps and everything. So.
Like you literally to flunk out of school for that though. You literally had to like online at least. You were playing against people constantly. There's always people online. You just playing with the same dudes all the time.
Yeah, man, just never leaving the room, just in there, you know? People going and coming to class, dude just sitting in there, steady playing GoldenEye all day. Miles, yeah. JR, what about y'all?
I was a big Sega Genesis guy growing up. I was a big Sonic the Hedgehog fan. Get as many rings as possible, go as fast as possible. So, you know, the thing I love about Sega is it kind of humbled you. Because sometimes the game didn't always work. Sometimes you had to take it out. You had to blow in it up and down for it to work sometimes. So then I graduated. I went to Sega Dreamcast, and I thought that was the best thing ever. And it made me fall in love with the 2K series. You know, you had Randy Moss on the front of NFL 2K. You had Allen Iverson on the front of NBA 2K. So those are my two games on Sega Dreamcast.
Man, and that Joe Montana football, I still – if that series had continued, it would have been probably the greatest football game ever. It was so far ahead of its time.
Yeah.
And then EA just came through and shut it all down. But there were so many features in that old school Joe Montana game that you still don't have in Madden today.
Yeah. And NFL 2K5, I believe it was, with T.O. on the front. That was like the best football game ever. Because you had the in the helmet. And you just had, you know, the highlights pregame. And you had the halftime highlights as well. So it definitely was ahead of its time.
What about you, Miles?
Yeah, for me, I'll go a little newer than what you guys did. We just lost Prince. All right, that's all right. I'll go a little newer. I mean, I love the N64. I love the you know, and all that, the Super Nintendo, everything. You know, playing. I really like the Mario 64. That was always fun. But the original Xbox, the two games that I like to play the most were Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic. I thought that was pretty ahead of its time for back then. And then the baseball game, MVP 2005 with Manny Ramirez on the cover. That was my – I played that. I'd probably still play that to this day if I could. So those are my two games.
Probably should have thrown Star Fox in there too on N64. I spent way too much time playing that game too back in the day. Well, all right, Yinka, that was a good one. That spurred on some nice discussion there. And in the last episode, we talked a little basketball. JR, we hit you with the random mock draft, and I think you went 5 for 5, right?
Yeah, you know, I know a little bit about basketball here and there. I was a basketball kid growing up, so it's kind of like my first love, so to speak, and then I fell in love with football. So quick story. I was a basketball kid growing up, as I said before. When I was 9, my dad signed me up for football, cried my eyes out. The only reason he made me sign up for it was he just didn't feel like I was tough enough. And here I am today. I love football, so I still love basketball this day as well. So it was fun, you know, watching the NBA draft. It kind of gets a little boring after the lottery. You start seeing all those international guys and guys you really never heard of. So, but I'm a guy that I always watch the NFL and the NBA draft all the way through. It's just something I've always done for whatever reason. I'm just a draft nerd, as everybody knows. But the top five was it kind of was predictable for the most part. But after that, it kind of took a turn, a big turn. Of course, the Jimmy Butler trade, the Timberwolves came in and stole the show. You know, I thought it was a great trade for them, and I really thought they stole away Jimmy Butler. And I'm sure Miles and Yinka can touch on that a little bit, as, you know, they're actually in the Minnesota market. And so how is Jimmy Buckets Land going up on there in Minnesota? How's he being treated or welcome?
Go ahead, Prince.
From everything that I've heard from a few people who know him, he's been great so far. Love him, love the personality that he kind of brings. I think Minnesota needed a Jimmy Butler. I mean, he's definitely an upgrade over, you know, the previous big three. I have talked to a few people who were very, very huge Zach LaVine fans and felt that he had tremendous upside and that, you know, he was a great player. So there are some people who are a little upset because of how much they love Zach LaVine, but I think Jimmy Butler, way to ways, is a tremendously better basketball player at this right now. I mean, not to say what's going to happen in the future, but right now, Jimmy Butler is easily the better player. So huge upgrade for the Wolves.
Yeah, I know everybody's. I think this is probably the most excited people have been, especially around the Timberwolves since the 04 season with KG, Sprewell, and Cassell, just because we haven't had this much star power on the Timberwolves since then. So it's exciting. You got Cat coming up, Andrew Wiggins coming up. So you expect those guys to continue to take those steps. I'm curious to see how Butler and Wiggins are going to play together because they're kind of similar in the way they play. You know, they both command the ball. They both, you know, penetrators. And, I mean, Wiggins doesn't play the defense that Butler does, but I think on offense they're pretty similar in the way they try to play. Obviously, Butler should be the go-to guy, especially early on. But I'm just curious to see how they're gonna kind of mesh. I know guys. What I like about Karl Anthony Towns and Andrew Wiggins, those guys just want to win. So I think that's the most important aspect right now. So I think they're gonna do whatever they got to do to help this team win games. And I think it'll be the first time we'll see them make the playoffs. And I think since that 04 season. So I'm excited. I'm excited about free agency. I haven't been this excited about free agency in a long time for the Timberwolves. So I think it'll be – if they can make the right moves, it could really get them going.
I think Jimmy –
Where do you think this positions you guys in the Western Conference? Because I know everyone in Minnesota is super excited right now, as well they should be. This is a great big move. Cat is – you know, one of the best young big men in the league. Wiggins getting better every year, number one pick for a reason. Then you bring in Butler, which is what they needed, a veteran on this team with all the leads they squandered they needed a veteran player to come in and help steer the ship, teach the young guys how to win. But I mean, you still got the Warriors out there. You still got the Rockets. Where do you think this positions the Wolves for this year and then the next couple? Like, how far away from being a contending team do you see the Wolves right now?
Well, I think before you even hit free agency, I think we're, if we were to say potentially that, if you're going to say potentially, you know, the season were to start today, and obviously they haven't filled their bench. They still have a lot of moves they need to make to kind of fill that bench. But I do think, you know, even before free agency starts, with the big three that they have with Butler, Wiggins, and Karl-Anthony Towns, and then you throw in a Ricky Rubio, who's a, you know, the distributor he is, this team could be anywhere from 6 to 8 seed, in my opinion. I think, you know, they have the opportunity to kind of get in that range. I'm still not going to put them up in the top echelon of the, you know, the West, because that's a hard group to break into. I think it was hard for Houston to do for a while. They finally did it. Oklahoma City's been there for a while too, and you know, the Spurs obviously have dominated for years, and Golden State's going to be that team for a while. So I think they have an opportunity to get themselves, you know, anywhere. I think if they hit the free agency the right way, they have a chance to be anywhere from 5 to 8, but I don't see anything higher than 5. I think 5 would be the absolute ceiling. And I think, you know, 8 should be the floor, because I think they're good enough now to finally make the playoffs.
Awesome. And sorry about that, Prince. What were you saying?
No, it's all good. I was just going to chime in and say, I think what Jimmy brings is he's a little bit better shooter. I know he's really kind of really similar to Wiggins in that respect, but I think he's definitely a better shooter than Wiggins can bring. But I'm optimistic, but at the same time, like Miles said, I think the biggest issues you saw with the Wolves last season, previous seasons, is their bench is horrible. So that's why I still kind of leave them at maybe a 7th at best, 8th seed. You know, but they definitely can surprise with, you know, the upside that they have now. It all depends on if you move on from Ricky Rubio, are you going to bring in a guy that is just as good as a distributor, a guy who can shoot a little bit better? I know that's where the Wolves are trying to lean towards, is becoming better shooting team. So, I mean, it really depends on what you do with Ricky. And if you do move on from Ricky, are you bringing a guy who kind of rounds out that bench a little bit better, or are you trying to even further boost what you have at the top with the big three? So it's definitely going to be a question going into free agency.
Yeah, and you just brought up really the next thing I wanted to talk about on this NBA front. Why are they so desperate to get rid of Ricky Rubio? I know we kind of talked about it a little bit, and we'll go to JR on this one, but Ricky Rubio stays in trade discussions, trade rumors, basically it seems year-round. And, you know, they traded for Jimmy Butler. Everyone was thinking that Rubio would be the guy out there distributing. And then you immediately start to hear rumors, you know, George Hill, Kyle Lowry. Yeah, given that Rubio has been good when he's not injured, why do you think that Tibbs is so eager, anxious to move on from Rubio?
Me personally, I really don't understand it per se, but Tibbs is a guy that loves athletic point guards, and obviously Rubio isn't that. He's more of a true distributor, but the one thing I do love about Rubio is that he fits perfectly for that team, considering that they have a whole bunch of scorers in Cat, Wiggins, and now Butler, and formerly with LaVine, who are all guys that need the ball in order to have an impact. Rubio doesn't really need the ball to have an impact. He's a guy that can play off the ball, but he's not a score first point guard. He's a pass first point guard. So you need that type of guard in order to, you know, coexist with those three guys. Because if you have a guy like a Derrick Rose, who Tibbs is a big fan of from his days in Chicago, a guy that is very ball dominant, I don't think he would fit very well with those guys, just because he's not able to play off the ball or put his ego to the side to be a distributor first, as opposed to being a score first point guard. So I wouldn't trade Rubio, just because he's on a very, very cheap contract as well. I believe guys like Jan Mahimi makes like $3 or $4 million more a year than Rubio, something crazy like that. So he's on a very team-friendly deal, and we all know this is the first year where that NBA TV deal kicks in, so those contracts are going to be ridiculous. Like Kyle Lowry is going to be making $30+ million a year, if that's the guy they want to target. And we all know Jason has great experience with Kyle Lowry up there Toronto, so I don't know if that's the guy that we're targeting.
But yeah.
But I think a guy that, if they do move on from Rubio, a guy that would fit well for him would be a guy like Patrick Beverley, who's not a, you know, a score first guy, but he's a guy that can shoot consistently enough and pass the ball consistently enough to be that point guard that they need. But I don't think he's a better fit than what Rubio is. But if they want a cheaper option or go-to option, so to speak, I think Patrick Beverley would be a good fit for them.
See, what I like, too, is you throw Rubio in with Butler is both those guys are – I'm not going to call Rubio an elite defender, but he's pretty – he's on that fringe of being, you know, one of the better defending point guards in the league. And he helps – those two would help free up Wiggins and I'll say Wiggins because Cat's kind of is different on the block, but they'll help free up Wiggins so Wiggins doesn't have to, you know, I won't say work hard on defense, but he won't have to do as much on defense, and he can concentrate on the offensive side of the ball. And, you know, Rubio and Butler can do the dirty work, you know, on the wings, you know, on defense. So that's just where I'm excited about too.
Yeah, the Wolves just really need shooting. That's what they desperately need. A guy like J.J. Redick would be really good for them, somebody that can just bring off the bench and just – be like that sixth man that just can come in and just light it up offensively, because we all know Wiggins and Butler aren't very consistent shooters outside of the three-point arc. So they need a guy that can just come in and just light it up, because they don't have that right now.
All right, so last call, last points here. Rapid fire. First Miles, then Yinka. If you could get any free agent into the Wolves this this offseason, who are you looking to add? Yinka, you go first.
My man Kyrie Irving, I think he should come over to the Wolves. But no, in all seriousness, free agent. I don't know who would have the biggest impact right now. Maybe Kyle Lowry probably be the best right now that I think would be achievable and still be able to somewhat do what you want as far as filling your bench. So that's going to be my recommendation.
And Miles, what about you?
It won't happen, but I think getting that stretch four next to Cat would be perfect. That's what they're really missing besides the bench and the sixth man and everything, the shooting. They're really missing that stretch four. I think Paul Millsap would be perfect. I think he'd fit great next to Karl Anthony Towns, and then it'd allow Gorgui Jang to move to the bench and be a really good power forward center, rotational bench player, which would be perfect for him, because then he can play – because he's really active and his high energy, that'd be really good off the bench. So I think Paul Millsap would be perfect.
Awesome. Well, we are going to transition really quickly. The kind of meat of this show will be us talking about, you know, quarterbacks, having a quarterback discussion as we enter this dead part of the NFL season. We're going to go through, do position by position player reviews, have a little bit of conversation about our favorite players in each of these position groups. So we're going to be talking quarterbacks tonight. But before we get to that, we have a special interview, I guess we'll call it, where we brought Hoodie back on to give his reaction to the Michael Floyd verdict and his thoughts on how the Vikings handled the whole situation. So hold with us for just a moment, and we will slide into that interview. And hopefully when we get back on the other side, Yinka will join us again. All right. So Hoodie, before the whole Michael Floyd court date, we had you on the pod, and you gave a very – very impassioned point of view in terms of your thoughts on the Michael Floyd situation and what was going on. At the time, excuse, as many of us thought, in terms of the kombucha tea being the reason for his failed tests. And at that point, we didn't really have much clarity, much certainty in terms of what was going to happen with the court date. It was looking pretty bleak for his future with the Vikings. And then today we get the court date. We get a official statement from Rick Spielman supporting Michael Floyd and saying that they expect him to serve his day in jail and week of house arrest and be back to join the team for training camp. You had the lead counsel for the Vikings back Floyd on his story of kombucha tea being the reason, the cause for the failed test. And, also making it quite clear that the Vikings encouraged all their players, including Michael Floyd, to partake in kombucha tea, both at their facilities and also encouraged them to have kombucha tea kind of off the facilities based on the, the somewhat nebulous health benefits that come along with the product. You had really strong opinions on it before. What are your thoughts on this whole situation now that it seems to have come to a legal resolution and the Vikings seem to be, not seem to be, the Vikings are, you know, unequivocally standing with Michael Floyd and backing him and his take on the situation and plan on having him on the team?
First of all, gentlemen, thanks for letting me on for this podcast to discuss this, this subject. I'm pretty upset and disappointed and embarrassed by the Vikings organization on this, on multiple levels. I think when we, when Warren sent that letter out, it's saying for the Vikings organization itself to encourage players to consume Kubaka tea as a health drink, and it's served quote unquote on tap at Winter Park, and this letter was basically co-signed by Vikings president Mark Wolf, Vikings general manager Rick Spielman, and of course our head coach Mike Zimmer. It tells me that either they were willfully ignorant on how alcoholism works, or they didn't understand or look into the fact that kombucha could have the possibility of having alcohol in it. And as a recovering alcoholic, I can tell you that could also lead to, which also can lead to a triggering of his alcoholism as well. Do I think that's what has happened? I don't know. I do think though that, I think the Vikings look really bad in this whole situation. I really do. I think they look absolutely horrible in this situation. And I think most importantly, they're enabling Michael Floyd's behavior as well, which I think is preposterous. And it's also, first of all, it's on Michael Floyd. First of all, this is all on him because of the fact that he knows what to drink and what not to drink. Period. Okay. And that's on him for doing that. And he has to understand that he knows what needs to be, what he has to do. He just does. I mean, as a person who has an issue with drinking, as like I have, you're told what to drink and what not to drink and what to stay away from. He should have known better. And at the same time, the Vikings as an organization should have known better as well. All it takes is a single minute or a few seconds to Google, does kombucha have alcohol in it? And the fact that this organization did not follow through on that to help him out and then decided to enable him by offering this letter, I'm not saying that they shouldn't support him. I think it's, you know, what they had. But what is really upsets me is the statement that they offered after their official statement, especially by Rick Spielman. And nowhere in this statement does it state that we as an organization made a mistake and or we as an organization, we're not thorough in our responsibilities to make sure that a gentleman with an addiction could cause a relapse or might have something in it. Nothing like that at all. The Vikings did not take, in this statement, in no way, shape, or form did the Vikings take any type of responsibility at all for I wouldn't say the actions of Michael Floyd, but their responsibility of making sure that if they're going to be offering something to someone who has an addiction issue, to make sure that he can't help trigger that addiction again. So I'm really disappointed and upset.
What do you make of some of the pushback that you've received? You know, and you know, we've kind of had some of the back and forth, and people have come at you a little bit on Twitter with, you know, some comments of, what if, you know, Michael Floyd's not actually an alcoholic? He's just a young guy who went out and had some drinks, and it's not documented. No one's actually coming out and saying that he's an alcoholic. He's just had a couple instances where, you know, he went out as a young guy and did something silly, and maybe we're blowing this a bit out of proportion. I guess what is your response to those kind of statements? Because I've seen a lot of people coming at you with those online.
Whether he's an alcoholic or not, I don't know. Okay. Only he knows for sure. But when you're sentenced by the court for 120 days for an issue like this, it tends to believe that he has an issue with alcohol. And I'm not saying he's alcoholic, but he has an issue with alcohol. Okay. So if this person has an issue with alcohol, it is a responsibility not just himself, but also the organization to make sure, especially since he's the one who has to give tests this often, it is the responsibility of Michael Floyd and it's the responsibility of the Minnesota Vikings to make sure that he upholds his responsibilities. And the Vikings did not do that by encouraging him to drink this drink. And obviously Michael Floyd did not do it because he did drink that drink. And I'm sure, I feel pretty confident saying there might've been something else as well. But, and that truly does bother me that they would go, look, I support them if they're going to support Michael Floyd to make sure that he becomes a better human being. Because in the end, that's all that counts. It doesn't matter. It should not matter anything else. It doesn't matter how good of a wide receiver he's going to become, how how much of a production he has for the Vikings. That none of that should matter. What matters is, can he be a productive human being in life and serve a productive life itself? And what the Vikings have done in this situation has not helped him become a productive human being in this stage of his life.
So I just want to chime in real quick.
One follow-up question, Miles, and then I'll turn it over to you because this question, it bleeds into something that we've talked about a couple of times as well. So given, the really low risk contract that Floyd was signed to, I guess first, we'll start with you, Hoodie, and then, anyone else can jump in. Miles, you can go first. Why do we think that the Vikings are standing by Floyd? Typically in a situation like this, when a guy comes in, has had some trouble, has that contract that the team can basically back out of with no negative implications, no negative financial repercussions, why do we think that in this situation, the team is coming out so strongly, so forcefully in support of Michael Floyd, a guy who hasn't played a real snap for them yet?
I have two theories. Well, there's two theories behind this. One football related, I guess. Someone brought this to my attention, and I agree with this as far as a lesser value point. But it seems like if they're going this far for Michael Floyd, it kind of tells me maybe that Treadwell just isn't ready to step up to be the third wide receiver. And if that's the case, if that's kind of the situation for that, I'm furious on the Vikings for that aspect, because you know what? It shouldn't matter. Like that's a, if it's a football and financial related decision, shame on the Vikings. Shame on the Vikings for doing that. If that's the reason why, I don't know if that's for sure. Maybe they feel, if that's the situation, that the Vikings do feel as though, the only other things I could think of is, okay, I try to put myself in the shoes of that organization and understand with Michael Floyd, okay? The only other thing I could think of is that, he did make an honest mistake. Maybe it was the same, the kombucha. And, we'll just try it with, we'll believe his story and we'll help him out with this. And again, I think to me, I if that's the case, again, that's another terrible take by the Vikings, because again, you're enabling the behavior of someone who struggles with using alcohol. And that is not how you handle that. I'm not saying they should just drop him and say, do all your time in jail. I mean, if they want to, I mean, they have every right to, but I don't see what good it was for them for their thinking process of what they did. And if they thought, if maybe they're taking Michael Floyd to his word that, to me, it just seems like rereading the story about it and then reading the statement, to me, it just seems like Michael Floyd was lying about the story itself, and the Vikings have gone along with it. And again, as I told last week about this, you can't, it involves me, you can't bullshit a bullshitter, okay? And to me, I think he's lying about his story, but the Vikings are still going to take his word for it. And I just, it's, I think it's just an absolutely huge mistake by the team.
All right, so as we are running short on time, Miles, I'll let you take us home on this one. What was your follow-up that you had there?
Yeah, well, it kind of goes in line with what you were saying, Jason, and your question about, you know, what the organization was doing. Personally, I think they were trying to get ahead of it. I think they were trying to really stay ahead of the whole situation because they know, you know, this whole kombucha drink thing for Michael Floyd, they're giving it out like water. So if they're giving it to a guy like Michael Floyd and then Michael Floyd gets in trouble and they don't come out and say anything, it's going to come out later on that the Vikings were kind of providing him and the rest of the team those kind of, you know, substances, whether it's not an illegal substance or anything like that along those lines, but
right.
Something that can potentially contain alcohol. They want to get ahead of it. And so that it's out now. So everybody knows that the Vikings provided it. They were, they're using it as a health, whatever, you know, a health situation, whatever, you know, but I just think they were trying to get ahead of it so that, you know, come training camp, come later down the road, you know, someone mentions it or someone's around the facility and they see all that kind of, you know, kombucha, however you say it, drink, you know, that tea, they're like, whoa, how long have you guys been giving that stuff away? And then they, you know, come back and find out that, you know, they were the reason Michael Floyd was potentially drinking it in the first place. I just think they're trying to cover their asses personally, so.
Yeah, I'm just going to chime in real quick. I put out a tweet a few months ago, actually, just before the draft, and I had said
something. Predicting the future?
Yeah. but I had said something along the lines of, you know, Rick Spielman wasn't really hampering on his patented phrase of, we really want to focus on bringing high character guys right. into the organization. And I know I got a little bit of flack for it. People were like, you're reading too far into it, all that other stuff. But I was like, you know, it's important to, you know, not pay as much attention to what an organization says, but more so what they do, but also even more so look at what they're not saying. And I think obviously what you saw with the Dalvin Cook pick, with the Michael Floyd acquisition, you are starting to see the organization, not in desperation mode, but they maybe are stretching where their moral compass is a little bit, because they, you know, they bring in guys that they feel like, hey, they could help them win. And, you know, in the past, you know, maybe they've looked at, like, you know, we've missed out on a few guys that maybe we wanted, but the character issues caused us to kind of raise a red flag and not go after that guy. Whereas now it's more so, you know, we want to win at all costs. And that might mean taking a little bit of slack from, you know, a guy who might be struggling with whatever he's struggling with. And we want to keep him around for that very reason. So that's just my two cents on the topic.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I guess the one piece there, and I kind of also am going with the cover your ass theory of this, because they want to keep Floyd around. They can keep Floyd around. I mean, it's not like he would be, I mean, in terms of people that they've kept around in the last few years, I mean, what he did is irresponsible, but it's nowhere near in the same category or level of issue of, you know, what we dealt with Adrian Peterson or anything like that. So, I mean, this is the NFL. There are all kinds of terrible guys that get to play in the NFL because they have the skill and to do so. So if they wanted to have Floyd, you know, play and be like, hey, he made a mistake and we're going to stand by him, I understand that. It just seems that they came out really, really forcefully, really, really, really quickly with, I mean, their chief legal people getting involved. And so that's the thing that I found to be different, is that, you know, you might have a coach come by and stand by a guy. You might have, you know, Rick Spielman get out there and be like, you know, we're going to stand by him. But the first words we heard on this were the lawyers, you know, and that's why I kind of feel like they are really trying to just cover their ass with this whole situation and get ahead of it, like Miles said, to make sure that this isn't something that lingers and becomes a bigger issue for them as they get into training camp.
Well, right. And to real quick, to that point, when the Vikings, when, you know, professional organizations in itself, look for things for players to, you know, to give to their players, you know, for vitamins, anything like that for them to consume. You know, they do their extensive research, so let's not sit here and act like they didn't know. They knew exactly what you know, the kombucha drinks have or what they could potentially contain if they get fermented even further. So, you know, I'm also, you know, assuming that they probably thought, oh, you know, there isn't very much and very little to no alcohol in this. You know, if it's not fermented to the point where, you know, it contains alcohol, we're trusted, we're giving it away, we're keeping it in a place where it's not going to continue to ferment and gain that alcohol substance to it. So that's another thing I think as a part of the reason why they wanted to cover their asses. They're like, we felt it wasn't a big deal if we gave, you know, Michael Floyd this because it's not going to contain, you know, very little to no alcohol. I'm not disagreeing with you at all, Hoodie. I think what you're saying is 100% accurate and correct. I agree with you on the stance. What I'm saying is where I think the organizational side is what they were thinking was, you know, we'll slide by. We'll get, you know, it doesn't contain alcohol. This shouldn't really do a big thing for Michael Floyd. It's not, you know, it's not going to get him enough to where it's going to raise his alcohol level, where they didn't think that. And then they probably gave, you know, each player a pack of, you know, teas to take home or whatever. And, you know, Michael Floyd brings his home, puts it wherever, you know, in the spot he probably shouldn't. And then it starts to ferment a little longer than it should and, you know, yada, yada. And then it, you know, then we're here now. So that's just kind of my thought on it.
So Hoodie, we'll give you the last word on this before we shut it down on this here segment. Yes. What are your final thoughts on everything?
Right. And kind of adding on to what Miles is saying, I understand that aspect of it. But just a reminder is that even someone who's struggling with a problem like with alcoholism or with alcohol itself, even the slightest amount, even if it's like considered quote unquote non-alcoholic beer or whatever, even if there's like even alcohol in food, like whatever it might be, okay? But even the slightest amount could cause or trigger a reaction for him to wanting more alcohol of some other sort. So with that aspect of it, again, the Vikings knowingly knew that this gentleman had a problem with alcohol, still allowed and have on record now saying that, you know, we encouraged this, or, you know, we encouraged him to drink it. It looks terrible on the organization. And more importantly, like Jason, you mentioned before, they had the lead legal counsel talk about, you know, going on forward. It would have been nice if we had heard from either Mike Zimmer, Eric Sugarman, Rick Spielman on this. So because this, to me, it brings back to like the seasons like 2000 and like 2010, 19, or like 2010, 2001, like the black cloud going into the season of, or even like even with 2014, like those little black clouds that are hanging over the head that have a chance, their ability to like ruin a season, like snowballs and everything else. I hope it doesn't happen, but man, I've lost a lot of respect and trust for the Viking organization and for Rick Spielman, Mike Zimmer, and Eric Sugarman after today.
Okay, well, Hoodie, we're going to need you to end us on a more positive note. So because you never, ever do on Twitter anymore, I'm going to need you to say something nice about Teddy before we sign this off.
What? No.
About Treadwell. I don't want to hear about – we talk a lot about Teddy. I want Treadwell.
Oh, boy.
Wait, you want, okay, well, first of all, I love Teddy, okay? And there's no ifs, ands, or buts about that. Exactly. I absolutely adore Teddy. I love Teddy.
Okay, then fine, Miles is right. We need something nice about Treadwell.
I think Laquan Treadwell has the ability to be the second greatest tight end in Vikings history. And I cannot wait, absolutely cannot wait for him to be, to move to tight end, Hodges the wide receiver, to have one of the greatest receiving tight ends and wide receiving groups in Viking history with those two right where they're supposed to be.
I hate to love you, man.
I cannot wait for Treadwell to become the second greatest tight end in Viking history. So how's that, guys?
That is perfect. Thank you very much, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Peace out, guys. Hey, guys, thanks again for everything. Have a great one.
Thanks for coming on.
All right. Well, we are back. Yinka is back with us too. So let's jump into this quarterback conversation. We know this is Yinka's favorite position to talk about, his favorite people on the field. He thinks that we should talk about quarterbacks more often than we do. The quarterbacks should probably get paid more money than they already do. Yinka loves talking quarterbacks.
What you lying about right now?
Oh, my bad.
Okay. I just want to make sure.
We know you like quarterbacks just a little bit, even if it's just to complain about him. So I'm going to let you go first with this conversation here. JR shared a tweet with us kind of showing four young quarterbacks. I think the options were Dak, Jameis, Mariota, and who was the last one?
Derek Carr.
And you're given the option, which one of those guys would you take if you were starting your franchise right now? So we'll start with you, Yinka. Which one and why?
I'll go with Jameis Winston. I know he's probably of the four, maybe not the most popular pick, but I'll go with him. I liked what I saw as far as leadership-wise, and I think that's a really important piece for me when I evaluate quarterbacks is being able to visibly see the leadership that someone like Jameis does. I mean, one of the first things you heard right away when he got into camp as a rookie was – you know, he was able to kind of command the huddle, be there, be the vocal leader that the team needed him to be. And he's kind of stepped in and gained a lot of respect of his teammates. And I think given that fact, I think you're starting to see a little bit more as people being a look at Tampa Bay as being kind of on the upswing of things. I would go Jameis. I think he has a great arm. I think that you know, he's obviously not the most athletic guy, but I think some of the tangibles that he brings in, I wouldn't mind starting my franchise with Jameis. So,
all right. So, Jameis, I guess, what do you guys think about that pick? Miles, JR, what do you think about Jameis as kind of your franchise guy?
I just think Jameis has to cut down on the turnovers and improve his accuracy a bit more right now. He has all the intangibles that you could want in a franchise quarterback. We all know he's a great leader. He's been that since he was in college at Florida State. The Florida State University.
Oh, boy.
Oh, yeah. Go Noles. But, you know, on the subject of Jameis, he's a fantastic young quarterback. But I just think he has some things he needs to clean up. Like I said earlier, his accuracy is probably the biggest one right now, especially in the red zone areas. He wasn't really good in the red zone last year. So I wouldn't take him over some of the other guys on the list. But me personally, I would take Dak Prescott. Just because what he did last year was incredible, considering everyone blames it on the surroundings and what he's surrounded by. But, I mean, we say the same things about Kirk Cousins, Andy Dalton, and Sam Bradford. So we can't continuously complain about his surroundings when he's taking advantage of what's around him. But, you know, the one thing I love about Dak is he doesn't put you in bad positions. He's always going to put you in positions to win the game. And he's never going to mess it up. That's the one thing I love about Dak. Does he have the arm talent that those other guys have? No, he doesn't. But he's going to outsmart you, and he always knows where to go with the football. He's great with progressions. He understands how to get through his reads, and he's not going to put you in bad situations, as I stated earlier. And we all seen in week one against the Titans what Mariota did. He basically threw the game away from them with the Eric Kendricks pick six. So, and that's the kind of things Mariota needs to improve on right now, just making bad decisions in key situations. So right now I will put it – I have Dak first. I actually have Mariota second. I will have Carr third, and I have Winston fourth. So that would be my order of the four.
Okay. Miles, Yinka, what are your thoughts on Dak Prescott? We won't go to Miles first because we know Miles rolls for Team Lightskin, and so you know we know Dak is his pick already. We don't really need his analysis. So we'll go, Yinka. You tell us what you think about JR's thoughts on Dak and that comp between Dak and Jameis.
No, I think a lot of the points that JR brought up about Dak is accurate. He's an intangible that I love about a quarterback is, you know, yeah, it's great to have a quarterback that wins you games or who has the ability to win you games, but I think it's just as equally important for a guy who doesn't make the mistakes when, you know, they matter. Dak has shown that he's highly intelligent. He's very mature beyond obviously just being his first year. He made some pretty crucial throws, especially down the stretch. you know, sans a few calls here and there, I mean, you could be seeing Dallas go a lot farther than they did this year. So yeah, I do like Dak Prescott. You know, I'm just a little more of a James Winston fan. So.
Okay, Miles, the floor is yours. Let us know. Tell us, why is Dak Prescott the greatest quarterback in the history of the NFL? Why is he your guy? Miles, let us know. What's up?
I wouldn't go as far as you did, but I think he just got the poise. He's for to come in for what he did and the pressure he had under him after you know, succeeding a guy like Tony Romo. That's really tough to do, and to be able to do it in his first year as a fourth round rookie. And it wasn't just the talent around him obviously helped everything he did, but he definitely made a lot of those guys around him, you know, better. You know, you saw Cole Beasley in the season he had. Obviously, Dez Bryant does Dez Bryant things. Wouldn't matter the quarterback there. But, you know, he continued to work with Jason Witten. The way him and Ezekiel Elliott meshed, I thought that was great. They really worked off each other really well. And I thought it allowed the Cowboys offensive coordinator, Scott Linehan, to kind of play to Dak's strengths, which is works really well with what Ezekiel Elliott does too. So, I think, you know, based off the situation, everything he's going through, you know, his mom had passed away, you know, over the, you know, a year and a half ago. He had the DUI. That's probably the big reason he got pushed to the fourth round. Through all of that, he was still able to come in and prepare as a starter and came into the season as a starter. And what did they win? 13? Was it 12 or 13 games? Whatever it was, they were top two seed in the NFC. So, you know, they're pretty much a stone's throw from Aaron Rodgers away from going to the NFC Championship. So I just thought he did everything he needed to do, and I just think he's going to continue to progress. He's not one of those guys. I don't expect to see a sophomore slump. I expect him to kind of take that Russell Wilson step where he continues to grow and be better the longer he's in the league. So I'm excited to see what he does.
Yeah, definitely can. And I know I'm giving you a little bit of a hard time about Dak, but Dak is he'd be number two on my list anyway. For me, the guy that I'm going with is Marcus Mariota, which is a pick that I'm probably a little surprised in when I started to go and kind of take a look at the guys, because Mariota wasn't a guy that I really loved when he was coming out of college. But the level of efficiency that he's displayed in his first two seasons has been very impressive. Tennessee runs that run-heavy offense, so Mariota hasn't really been given the opportunity to really open it up, but he was super efficient, you know, in his first season, and then he got better last year. And the funny thing is, we're going kind of Dak, Mariota, or Dak, is that if you go to playerprofiler.com and look up the best comparable player for Marcus Mariota, it's Dak Prescott and vice versa. So they're very similar. And in terms of how they performed, you know, they have a metric called production premium on Player Profiler that basically measures how effective a player is versus every other player on similar downs and distance. And Mariota was number one in efficiency. I think Dak was number three, right? So they're right there with one another. It's really a coin flip, but for me, just because Mariota has more snaps, more seasons, and has improved in, you know, both of his seasons that he's been in the league, and just the situation that he's in with that young offensive line and the skill positions they keep adding around him, I just think that that Mariota is very well positioned to continue to ascend, and efficiency for me is the thing that I really look for. It's one of the, I guess, the measurable traits that I covet the most when I'm looking at quarterbacks and evaluating how well they play is that efficiency piece. And Mariota, has improved on that in both of his seasons. But that I'll segue, I guess, because I know for me, I'm very much about, you know, the metrics and digging in, and quarterback efficiency is really the thing that I'm looking for. When I'm looking to evaluate quarterbacks, it's one of the reasons that I will continue to beat the drum for Russell Wilson and telling people that he is, to date, a far superior NFL quarterback than Andrew Luck based on what he's done on the field because of how efficient he's been in the passing game for the Seattle Seahawks. For you guys, when you're looking at quarterbacks, and I will start with our resident quarterback, QB1, when you're looking at quarterbacks and you're doing your evaluations, I guess, what are the traits that you're looking at? What do you see as being the most important things? Because I know that you are more of a tape analysis guy in how you break guys down.
Well, with me, it's a lot of things that go into it, but the biggest thing I do with a quarterback is I try to isolate everything around them. And what I mean by that is don't take into account the system they're running. Don't worry about the players that are around them. Just evaluate the player, no matter what they're in, whether it's a college prospect that's in a triple option or if they're in the spread. So I look at quarterbacks from the ground up. That's how I was taught. And, I mean, that's how I was taught the position is you got to be good starting from the ground up. And coaches always tell you, I can teach you. I can teach you footwork. I can't teach you what's going on in your head. It's all mental at the quarterback position. So when I'm looking at a quarterback, the first thing I start with is how good is their footwork? Are they pointing their toe to their target? How are their drops? Are they getting depth on their drops? What exactly are they doing? What are they processing on this play? So I start from the ground up, like I said. I look at their feet. So let's take those four guys into account. All those guys have tremendous footwork, and all of them have tremendous mechanics. None of them have a funky delivery. The one that probably has the most funkiest delivery out of the four is probably Jameis Winston, just because he has an elongated release out of all the other guys. But none of them have, you know, an unorthodox release, so to speak. But continuing on the ground-up theory, it's kind of hard to explain just because there's so much that goes into it. But I think the guy that probably has the best footwork out of all of them will probably be Derek Carr at the moment, just because he's been in the surroundings all his life. You know, he got to see his older brother actually go through the same exact situation that he was in. So he probably had more training at the time than those other guys. And I'm a firm believer in it. If you're around it all your life, you'll probably grow up to be it as well. So he's got to see exactly what David went through in his life. So he's probably had more proper training than those other guys. That's not a knock on those other guys' mechanics, because all those guys have very good mechanics. None of them were, you know, negative or anything like that. So I think all those guys are great quarterbacks. But just staying on the subject of what exactly I look for in the quarterback, the next thing I look for is the mind. I try to envision what quarterbacks are thinking on this play, just put myself in that same situation that they're in. And that's why I like looking at all 22 film as opposed to just a sideline view film, because there's certain things you miss if you just see a sideline view film. So the biggest thing I try to look for is, what is their progression? Is it a quick game read? Is it an intermediate read? Is it a deep read? Or is it a short intermediate to deep read? Or are they reading it deep intermediate to short? So there's a lot of things that go into actually looking at what the quarterback is going through. And you can't just look at it from your point of view. You have to put yourself in their shoes and just try to think what they're thinking. So it's kind of hard to explain, but I play the position. So I try to talk to people as if they're robots and try to put them in my shoes as well. So it's a lot of things that go in the quarterback position, but that's why they get paid the big bucks. It's a lot to go into. It's hard to explain.
So, Miles, I know that you'd made mention that, you know, QB is sometimes for you one of the more difficult evaluations. But when you are kind of breaking down film and looking at quarterbacks, like, what are you looking at? What are the main traits? Because, I mean, everyone evaluates differently, especially when you're getting into something like a film review, a film analysis. Kind of what are the things that you're looking for? What are your preferences when you're breaking down quarterbacks?
I think for me to start, especially a prospect coming out, I think the biggest thing and the most important thing for me, it's how they react in that pressure situation, in that pocket, because within that pocket, everything on TV and everything, sometimes it may look bigger than what it really is on the field, because it's really not as big as some people really, I mean, sometimes it is, but in reality, it's probably not as big as it actually looks. And then how quarterbacks perform in that chaos, because there's just so much going on around them, how they, you know, guys diving around their feet, you know, lanes opening up in certain angles, and how are they handling that? You know, they stepping into certain things, you know, moving around, keeping their eyes downfield. I think a lot of those things are really important for me, because to me it shows that's stuff that translates to the NFL. That's stuff that if a guy's not afraid in the pocket, at least in college, they're not going to be as afraid early on. You know, sometimes, you know, a perfect example is David Carr, who, you know, ended up being who kind of ended up getting that skittish and, you know, getting scared in the pocket because he kept getting hit so much. But I think early on, I think he could have been a lot better than he was if he'd had a better offensive line in front of him to kind of help develop him into that. But I think that's my biggest trait, obviously, just to not get off topic. But, you know, the chaos in the pocket, how quarterbacks react in that chaos, and, you know, calm, cool, under pressure. That's kind of my favorite part of traits about watching a quarterback.
Yeah, and I think that's a really great one because that's something that I don't think we talk about enough, but I think it's one of the most important skills for a quarterback. The guys, the best in the game, you see it. They have that innate ability to, you know, move around, you know, climb the pocket, slide, find, buy themselves a little bit of extra time. And I know, I imagine, and JR can let us know if we're wrong on this, that it's something that's drilled a lot and has worked on a lot, but it just seems like some guys just have it and other guys just don't. And that seems to be a skill that when you are evaluating and looking at the great ones, that most of them have that ability to just buy that extra second, you know, feel that guy moving in and make that just subtle little move to buy the time needed to make that play downfield.
Tom Brady's the perfect one at it too. Yep.
And you never, and that's one of those things, like, and JR was kind of talking about it the other day where, you know, big strong arm quarterbacks, like every year, everyone goes crazy over that guy with the big arm who can throw it, you know, 90 yards downfield. But it's, yeah, we very rarely hear a lot of good analysis that really breaks down, you know, which guys are good in the pocket, moving around, buying time, you know, making, you know, keeping things on schedule and making plays. And that is the talent that I think a lot of the great ones really do have. Yanka, how about you? What are you looking at when you're evaluating quarterbacks? And then when you're done with your answer on that one, why don't you just transition us into a discussion about the article that you did just write for Daily Norseman that digs into a bit of quarterback evaluation and kind of how teams should be looking at those things.
Yeah, I focus on, I'm not sure if you guys heard about the three Ps. I focus on pocket pressure, and precision. So obviously I look at what, first and foremost, looking at what the quarterback does within the pocket, you know, the subtle movements that they do. Do they climb? How's their lateral movement? Are they able to, how they're able to escape the pocket? Are they able to manipulate the pocket? So I'm just looking at all the things that they're doing, you know, with their feet, their body, little subtle movements that they can do, how they handle pressure. That kind of goes in, it kind of coincides a lot with what they're doing into the pocket, but how they're able to just distribute the ball based on, you know, what's coming. Can they buy themselves a little bit more time, when the pressure is coming from their blind side? Can they, can they effectively get the ball knowing that they're going to get blasted by, you know, pressure that's coming right in their face up the middle? And then obviously precision. I love watching a quarterback. For me, the deep shots are great, but I love watching a quarterback who can hit, hit an outright out route with perfect timing away from a defender where, you know, only the receiver could get it. So those are the kind of the big three that I always look at when I'm evaluating the quarterback. And then based on that, you know, some of the things that JR is touching on, I try to put myself, in the brain and the eyes of what the quarterback's trying to see, and try to make, you know, sometimes what I'll do is I'll just see the play, pause it, and look at, okay, where would I go with the ball? You know, what's my first read? And, you know, I kind of try to play that little guessing game. You know, a lot of times I'm wrong. I get to understand kind of the brain and the thought process of what the QB is trying to do. That's my evaluation. And I kind of segue into the article I put out. I kind of put it's called 3 years and out. It just kind of focuses on, you know, we hear about this 3-year window with a lot of quarterbacks. You know, what's this 3-year window mean? What is, how can we use that to better evaluate, you know, do we have our guy, or do we maybe need to be okay with hitting the reset button, with a guy after 3 years? So I kind of broke down, I took Vikings quarterback Sam Bradford, and I kind of looked at some other quarterbacks who had some similar time with him as him. And, you know, something consistently that I was seeing is obviously, you know, I only took two metrics or two stats, really. I took yards per attempt, and then I also took the ESPN version of QBR. Our good friend Luke, he actually broke down that those are some pretty highly correlated stats when it comes to, you know, QB efficiency and winning and whatnot. So that's why I kind of looked at those two. Something that I can kind of consistently saw is, you know, a lot of QBs as far as, yards per yards per attempt. You know, we're hovering around, even young QBs were hovering around that, you know, 7 yards per attempt. And as far as QBR, they were hanging around 59. They hanging around right around 59.04 or something, I think it was. So I use that as, I didn't go into like any standard deviation or anything. I wanted to expand on that. But the reason why I chose to break down those specific two is I know that there's some other stats that might help, DVOA as well as ADOT. Like those are some really good stats. But for those who might not have access to finding some of those stats, I was trying to more or less transition people away from just looking at, you know, how many touchdowns and interceptions are these quarterbacks throwing. And that's the way that I'd measure them, and trying to transition them to, okay, well, these are maybe some of the stats that we, you know, that better tell the story that when we're trying to figure out, is our quarterback doing well in the first couple of years? These are some of the things that we can kind of look towards. So.
Yeah, and I, you know, I definitely like the metrics that you chose there, especially that yards per attempt, because that is, I think, the most important metric for a quarterback. It's, you know, how effectively are you able to move the ball down the field? You know, all the rest will come. If you're getting the ball down the field efficiently, the touchdowns will come, the scoring will come. So for me, I love that you chose that metric. And what you found, I think, actually aligns very well with another study that Chase Stewart had done on Football Perspectives back in 2014, where he looked at 42 of what would be considered the greatest quarterbacks of all time. And basically what he was able to find is that you basically, within the first 3 years, if your quarterback is going to be great, they will likely have had an above average season within that time frame. And so if you have a guy and he hasn't popped, I guess we'll say, in the first 3 years, you probably should be looking for somebody to replace him at that point, because it's probably not going to happen, or his ceiling won't be as high as maybe as you were hoping. So it's interesting that you went with a different methodology and we're still able to come to a very similar conclusion. So yeah, it's good work. And we'll definitely link to the article that you wrote in the show notes so that people can check that out if they haven't already. JR mentioned it very, very briefly there, talked about quarterbacks and why they get paid the big bucks. And I wanted to have a real quick conversation on this. Are quarterbacks getting paid too much money? And
yes.
Are we at a point now where, yeah, maybe it's not in the best interest of your team to pay all these quarterbacks the amounts of money that they are being paid? So understanding that, you know, if you have an elite guy, which there aren't very many of, pay him. But if you don't have that elite guy, should you be paying that guy $25 million a year or more? So I just wanted to get y'all's thoughts on that one.
No and no. Don't pay quarterbacks. That's my take.
And Miles is just over here shaking his head. Miles, what are your thoughts, man?
I'm not saying to pay quarterbacks, you know, obscene amount of money, but I'm not saying that they're not the most important position in sports, so they probably should be the highest paid player on most teams. I take the Derek Carr example as I think they rushed to giving him that much money too quickly, especially when you have things like the franchise tag in your back pocket. I have a hard time giving a young quarterback his third year in the league, getting hurt, having a season-ending injury, and making him the highest paid player in the NFL. I have a hard time doing that. I probably would have waited to let this season play out, and probably would have, if I had to, I would have franchised him and kind of gone that route. But, yeah, for me, it just all depends on the quarterback. All depends on the situation. You know, coming down the, you know, down the road, I think Russell Wilson was, you know, really smart in what he did. He didn't lock himself into a long-term commitment with the Seahawks. He kind of did I think it was a four-year, 80-something million-dollar contract with, I think it was 40 or 50 guaranteed. So I don't think that completely hamstrung that entire roster. I think they could still do some stuff around him, you know, keep some of those key defensive players that they have. So it's all about for me, it's all about how your roster is formatted and how you want it to format. Cause you need, you know, some teams they take it and they use most of the, you know, high paying money for the offensive side, you know, and very minimal on the defensive side in certain areas. And then, you know, kind of varies depending on, you know, depending on the team. So that's just kind of my thought.
You know, and well, JR, we'll go to you next in terms of, you know, are we paying quarterbacks too much money? And I know that you, I almost feel like you're torturing yourself with this a little bit, where you keep going and checking on Spotrac to see what Sam Bradford's projected free agent value is going to be. But you look on there and you see, you know, a projected value for a guy like Sam Bradford that's north of $20 million. You see a guy like a Kirk Cousins that, by most people's account, they feel like Kirk Cousins is a product of his surroundings and he needs to have as much help as he can get. Like, what are your thoughts on those guys? And should teams be paying those type of guys the amount of money that it looks like they are set to get on the open market?
So after the Derek Carr deal, there's now 14 quarterbacks that make north of $20 million, which is right at league average, 32 teams in league, 16 teams, so right around league averages, so to speak. Are certain ones overpaid? Absolutely. Are certain ones underpaid? Absolutely. Take a guy like Tom Brady, for example. He makes, I think, $14 million a year. Tom Brady has been stealing out of his own pockets for the longest. He should have reset the quarterback market 5-6 years ago. I think Tom Brady is worth at least $30 million a year. That's just my opinion. He's been stealing out of his own pockets. You can make that face all you want. And I know we said the Patriots quarterbacks are a product of the system, but I think Brady is a guy that right now is irreplaceable just because of what he brings to that team. We've seen Garoppolo step in there and have success, but I don't think he can do it over a season of longevity like Brady has done. We've seen Jacoby Brissett step in there and have one good start, and otherwise it's been awful. So Tom Brady is a prime example I use of a guy that deserves more money than what he's getting, and I think quarterbacks should be paid a lot more than what they're getting certain ones. Now, on the other hand, you take a guy like Mike Glennon, who stole from the Bears this offseason, I like to say, getting $18 million, and he hasn't played a game in 2 years. He's been sitting behind Jameis Winston for a while since he's been drafted. So I think it just depends on the situation that you're in, depending on the quarterback that it is. Then you take a guy like Andy Dalton, who we've been very critical of. This is where it gets kind of tricky, because – is he replaceable? Yes. Is he kind of irreplaceable? Yes. Because we've seen AJ McCarron step in there. He's had success, and he's had his ups and downs as well. So it's kind of a touchy subject, and I think it's just kind of based on the actual quarterback. So then you take a guy like Sam Bradford, who we're in a situation with right now. Will we get caught up in paying Sam Bradford if he has another good season? We don't know. Is Sam Bradford replaceable? Yes. If he has another good season, is Sam Bradford replaceable? We don't know. So it just depends on the situation that you're in and who the actual quarterback is. And like I said, it's a touchy subject, and it's just based on the team, in my opinion. But I think quarterbacks should be paid more depending on exactly who it is. That's just my opinion. So it kind of goes back and forth. It's a seesaw thing, man. It just depends on the quarterback and the situation.
What were your thoughts on the Derek Carr signing then?
I think they had to do it just because you got guys like Khalil Mack coming up. You got Gabe Jackson coming up. They're going to have to use that franchise tag on one of those guys. And you go ahead and pay Carr. Just go ahead and get his money out the way. And I think he only got like $40 million guaranteed. So he didn't have a lot of guarantees in his contract. And I think they can get out of it after 3 years. It becomes a year-to-year deal after that. I believe that's what I read. So I think they had to do it just because we know Khalil Mack is going to break the bank. He's going to get Von Miller-type money. And Gabe Jackson is going to break the bank too. So you can't pay both those guys at the same time. You're going to have to franchise one of them and pay one of them. So I think it was smart at the time for what they did.
And so we know where Yink is at on this one here, where don't pay him nothing. But yeah, go ahead, Yink. Tell us why we shouldn't pay him.
Let me give a more serious take. I mean, I don't want them to get paid, but at the same time, I think I really actually like and respect what Tom Brady has done. And not very many people are going to do it. you know, obviously there's kind of this like sweet spot that, you know, you can obviously get paid, be the most the highest paid quarterback, all that stuff. But I think what Tom Brady did is he kind of hit that sweet spot with, I'm going to make sure I get my money, but at the same time, to alleviate some of that pressure on me to be, even though I am one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time, I'm going to give my team a little bit of wiggle room to be able to, again, alleviate some of that pressure off of him. Yeah, but, you know, as far as Derek Carr, you know, he's now the highest paid player now, and now the pressure is on for him. You know, he's going to have to perform at a very, very high level for the next, you know, at least the next 3 years, because he is the highest paid player currently right now. So as far as quarterbacks, yes, I do agree. There are times where you're going to need to pay them. But at the same time, I think you obviously, like you said, depending on what your roster is, if I have a good enough quarterback and I have kind of the Tom Brady type competitor who really, really just cares about, yeah, he wants to get paid, but he really cares about winning. You know, can I give ourselves some wiggle room when it comes to negotiations? Like, hey, you might not, you know, maybe we give you a little bit more guaranteed money, but we're going to obviously drop your salary a little bit more. But that'll allow us to bring in, you know, this big name free agent or, you know, left tackle or defensive end or corner or whatever the case is. That's going to make your job that much easier for us to win. So as far as playing quarterbacks, yeah, I understand why they're the highest paid players. But at the same time, a lot more times I see it is they're overpaid than, you know, actually getting paid what they should be.
And I'm surprised, but I'm actually going to agree with Yinka on this one here, in that, yeah, the Patriots, I mean, they're showing us the way. And we all acknowledge on a fairly regular basis that probably the biggest competitive advantage you can get in the NFL is hitting on a young quarterback on a rookie deal and then maxing out your roster everywhere else around him, because not paying a quarterback $20+ million a year is a huge advantage for you in terms of how you build out the rest of your roster and what you can surround that guy with. And then you look at the Patriots, who have Tom Brady, who is, you know, greatest quarterback of all time by many folks' estimation. And they went and sat down, and like Yinka said, they said, okay, we're going to fully guarantee this contract, but your cap hits, but your yearly amount is going to be less than others. And so you have Tom Brady on the biggest value contract in the league right now, $15 million a year. And so I guess for me, what I'm looking at, like if I'm looking at optimizing my roster construction, when I'm building my team, I understand that the quarterback market is going up and up and up, and you know, mediocre guys are getting paid ridiculous amounts of money. But I look at a team like Baltimore, Joe Flacco goes on a four-game run, essentially, a four-game run of being really, really, really good. They win a Super Bowl, and then they make him the highest paid player in the league.
They got caught in the moment.
Yeah, they got caught up in the moment. They got caught up in emotion. And what does that team look like since? Like, they have been on a steady decline since they maxed that man out. And then I can't remember who was it. I think it might have been Adam Patrick, who noted that when they were showing the list of guys who were around Derek Carr on that list of highest paid quarterbacks per year, none of them made the playoffs last year. You know, and that could have just been, you know, a quirk or whatever, but it seems like a lot of times that you get these guys who are just okay, teams go and pay them a bunch of money, and then that's basically the beginning of the end of the run for that team. And it's just, you know, like that you mentioned Andy Dalton. They paid him what wasn't a lot of money. They paid him a bit of money, but as time has moved along, you know, they can't pay everyone that was surrounding anymore. And you know, they go from making the playoffs every year and going out the first round of the playoffs to just not making the playoffs and then not being able to keep Whitworth and not being able to keep Zeitler. And, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see, like, you know, what a team like the Bengals is now that they paid that guy who is probably replaceable, but now he can't be surrounded by all the things that made him awesome, because now his offensive line is probably going to be, you know, Viking-esque when you get in the next year.
Well, another person to talk about with that too is Aaron Rodgers. I mean, obviously we all don't like Aaron Rodgers or what the Packers do, but I mean, you look at his contract situation, and they signed him to a 7-year contract with the opportunity to get after 5 years. at the time is a pretty big number, and he was at the time the highest paid quarterback in the league. But then, you know, as obviously the scale goes up, and all these other guys are getting paid, Rodgers starts going down toward the median, and now it's looking like they can keep Rodgers until he's what, I think it's like 35, with like the highest cap hit he'll get is $21 million, which that's by the time what the end of that contract is, 2019 season, by then that's the median, like that'll be the median, that won't even be, he'll be at the, you know, I'm sure they'll probably try to renegotiate before then. Oh, but
hold on 1 second, Miles, is your microphone sitting on your zipper?
Yeah, my bad.
Okay, we want the folks to be able to hear, you know, the brilliance that's coming from you right now. And it sounded like somebody was like sawing wood or something every time we moved right there. So
I hate when that happens.
Miles, that's my play. You can't just be messing up like that. Right,
I know. You know, learn from the best.
So what were you saying about Rodgers and the value deal that the Packers have him on?
No, yeah. So he signed a 7-year deal with the opportunity for him to kind of them to get out of for five with no debt, with no cap. But essentially, it's just a 7-year deal, which ends in 2019 now, which started back in 2013. But, you know, the highest his cap hit will ever go is $21 million, which is in the 2019 season, which by then, you know, you're looking at, you know, kind of the trajectory of what the quarterback pay scale is. And that'll be at the median. You know, if they even get to that point with Rodgers and get him that'll be the median. He'll be sitting at like the Tom Brady-esque type deals at that point where you're like, man, that guy's grossly underpaid. I mean, arguably the best quarterback in the league right now. Him and Tom Brady are the top two quarterbacks in the league, and they're not even in the top five in pay anymore. So it's pretty crazy how it works that way. But you know, as a team, when you structure it that way with a player, then you do that as in, you know, we have an opportunity to build around that player with, you know, significant amount of really good players that can sign around him. So I think it was a really good move by the Packers to do that in that sense. Not that I want them to do well or or am I rooting for them, but I think that what they did was smart. And
well, we'll edit that part out so nobody hears you say anything nice about the Packers. Don't worry about it.
I couldn't.
Yeah, don't worry. We'll just edit that out. It'll just be a long thing right there while you're saying nice stuff about the Packers.
I got a random question. So, we all seen on Spot Track that Sam Bradford's market value is at $23.5 million right now. And we've seen, Ben Gessling, the Vikings beat reporter for ESPN, come out and say that Tom Kahn and Sam Bradford's agent is looking for around $40 to $50 million guaranteed. So, let's say Sam repeats his success from last season and the Vikings win a playoff game. Are you paying Sam Bradford?
No, like me,
they are though. Yeah. Personally, probably not.
The team would probably pay him, and I would have to think that it would be a mistake. Like if Sam repeats what he did last year, which was, you know, average or below average efficiency across most metrics that actually matter. Like completion percentage is a nice soundbite, but it's not a metric that really leads to you winning games, especially if you're getting that at the expense of, you know, third down conversions and things of that sort. Like, for Sam to get paid that amount of money, I think Sam needs to have a better season than he had this past year for it to actually be worth it. Like, Sam played, if you kind of measure him and average out across all the metrics, Sam played right around league average. And in my opinion, you shouldn't be paying league average quarterbacks $20-plus million. You know, I think you can find league average in a vet minimum type player while you bring someone in the draft, try to groom, and you can build a stronger squad around those guys versus paying a quarterback $20 million and then having to make tough decisions about, you know, players on your defense or offensive line or whatever it might be. So if it was me and he just repeats what he did last year, I'm absolutely not giving him that amount of money, because I think that would be like, you know, kind of our Flacco type situation where you get caught up in the moment and it's, you know, the beginning of tough decisions that you need to make to try to keep talent around a guy who has shown himself to be just okay at that point.
I do have a question, though, to kind of piggyback out of that, though. If his efficiency and everything does go up and he does kind of that efficiency, like you've been saying, Jason. And he does start playing, you know, significantly better, you know, the yards per attempt, the completion on third down and all that, yada, yada. And that gets better and it goes up. And he gets to that top echelon. I'm not saying top five or anything, but, you know, in that top 12, 10 range. But the team doesn't win, then what do you do?
I guess for me, based on the defense that we have, I have a difficult time seeing us get to a place where Sam Bradford is playing at a, you know, a heightened level of efficiency. Let's say it breaks into the top 10 in terms of efficiency. So we're not going to say he's, you know, like Russell Wilson level elite or like where Matt Ryan was last year, but he's top 10 in terms of, you know, where he is for, you know, adjusted net yards per attempt or even just yards per attempt. Let's put it at, you know, just make it simple at yards per attempt. I just think that if he's able to move the ball that efficiently down the field, which means if that happens, that he is taking more shots down the field, that he's better in the intermediate range. And I think being better in the intermediate range will translate to us being better on third down and things like that. I just don't see any way where if the offense is performing at that heightened level of efficiency and the defense is still, you know, a top five, top 10 level defense, that we aren't winning games. So that's where I'm at. Yeah.
Just a hypothetical though, because I don't think everybody always says he has to win a playoff game, but like at the end of the day, it's not always about, you know, the quarterback obviously is the most important position, but he's not the sole proprietor of, you know, the team winning or not. You know, it kind of becomes a whole team thing, but at the end of the day, he could play really well and they could not win.
Yeah, so. The Tony Romo effect. And people understand Tony Romo is just because he played on all those really bad Cowboys team. But yeah, if Sam Bradford takes that big step up and you know, lives up to the talent that he has that made him the number one overall pick, if you have to pay him because he's earned it based on his feel on the play, you know, pay him. But paying him based on, well, you know, he's better than who we've had in the last little while, or yeah, those type of arguments that we see kind of regularly on Twitter, like I'm not about all of that. But before we go too far down the rabbit hole where, you know, we end up getting the usual feedback that we're being too negative on Sam, we're going to wrap it up with some rapid fire. Yinka, I want you to start us off. Rank the quarterbacks in the NFC North.
Aaron Rodgers, Matthew Stafford, Sam Bradford, and then whoever is playing in Chicago.
Okay. Miles, you're up.
I'm probably the same. Rodgers, Stafford, Bradford. The Chicago dude, Glennon. Mike Glennon, Case Keenum. I'm done. That's it. The top four, yeah.
Okay. JR, what about you? Are you the same as the other guys, or do you have anything different?
I'm shocked Prince didn't name Teddy Bridgewater.
That
is shocking.
Teddy Bridgewater.
I'm shocked. So, yeah, I agree with everybody to this point.
All right. Well, since you got nothing else to add on this point, JR, I need you to tell us a little bit about this upcoming series you teased real quickly on Twitter. But you can be putting some work in here with these scouting reports. So let us know what's coming, man.
Yeah, so everybody knows I'm a draft nut, and I just watch film, grind the tape, as you guys like to say. Burn your eyes, as I like to say. It's what I've been doing all spring and summer, so. What I'm putting together is 32 prospects in 32 days, and basically it's just jumping around different positions on my big board. I haven't put together my actual big board, but just guys that I've watched all spring and summer and just highlighting 32 prospects in 32 days, 2018 guys. So it's something I'll be coming out with starting tomorrow. I'll put up USC quarterback Sam Darnold.
Get a job, man. God.
Yeah, man.
Oh man, that is awesome. And Prince, I mean, you have been on an amazing run here. I mean, burning up the library card, pumping out articles like it's nobody's business, dog. What you got next, dude?
Bertha knows me quite well. She has, you know, usually a cup of hot chocolate or something waiting for me. I think I might
chocolate all right.
What I have next is I think I'm going to do some camp battles type stuff. And then I was thinking about kind of expanding on this three-year window thing, but I think I was going to kind of blow it up even bigger. I haven't quite decided what I'm going to do, but I'm going to kind of, oh, that's what I was going to do. No, I was going to actually look at the strengths and weaknesses of our upcoming schedule in terms of, you know, what each team does really well and how we can attack them versus what they don't do well and how, you know, we might potentially be vulnerable on that. So, yeah.
Well, that is awesome. And if you are listening to the show, I hope you will have already read the article that I put out today. But if not, go check it out on the I Don't Hate Sam Bradford blog. Wrote a little bit about what the Vikings offense needs to do to improve. Basically boils down to offensive line needs to be better. Dalvin needs to do what he does. We need to be better on third down. Shermer and Sam need to break some tendencies, go downfield a little bit more often. And shoot, what was the last thing? Oh, yes. Miles's point that I had to get in there is we have to be better in the red zone. And what I'm saying we need to do to be better in the red zone is to pass a little bit more in the red zone instead of trying to out tough people when we get down there. Who? Fett, who?
If you want to score a little bit better, you should probably take Diggs out.
You're edited out. Just that's not even going to make it into the pod right now. So, you ain't got here slandering the man's pun, but I think that's it. Anyone else got anything upcoming? Miles, we know, you know, wedding stuff, fittings, all that. You on track? You good? Anything that you need to get done that hasn't been done yet, man?
I don't know. Probably.
You get more and more excited every time we talk about this. That is the happiest day of your life you got coming
that
up.
That is man. A it's broken. That is a it's broken
going,
man.
It's just going too slow at this point.
Happiest day of your life, man. You know, smile about it a little bit
like
more.
2.5 weeks, and it's just going so slow.
Well, that's pretty much it. We're gonna get the background music going around right now. Yinka is over here folding his laundry, so. Yeah, thank you for listening to another episode of the Climbing the Pocket Podcast. Gentlemen, thank you for coming on with me this evening. And y'all have a good one.